Welcome to the Brown County Hour.
Coming to you from the legendary hills of Brown.
Where the plum purple haze,
the one nature herself drapes over the hills and hollers,
inspires local characters, artists, and nature lovers.
It's as though the hills themselves conspire to create a beauty and a culture in the heart of Indiana.
Sit for a spell and hear the music.
The tall tales.
True stories.
And current goings on.
Brought to you by folks who still know how to sit by a fire in winter.
And swim buck naked in summer.
Welcome to episode 27 of the Brown County Hour. This is Dave Seastrom with guest host Cheeky Rose, and it's our pleasure to present the new show.
This month, along with an essay by Dave Seastrom and some commentary from Rick Fettig, we have several interesting interviews. Bill Miller, a longtime soil and water agent, shares his life experience. Jim Schultz will be talking about the Salt Creek Restoration Project. And Mike Hader will be telling us about the Ukulele World Congress taking place next weekend right here in Brown County.
We also have an interview with local finger-picking luminary Kara Barnard. We'll listen to some of her great music and hear about the Indiana Fingerstyle Guitar Competition coming up this July.
In our first segment, we'll hear of Bill Miller reminiscing on his experience in the early days of the Peace Corps and our interview with Kara Barnard, including some of her fabulous music.
This is Vera Grubbs with the Brown County Hour. I'm here with Dave Seastrom. I am so pleased to tell you that we have Bill Miller with us, who will give us the best of his memories of Brown County.
Well, Bill, let's talk about the Peace Corps.
Okay, that's one of my favorite subjects.
So you were in the very first Peace Corps, as I recall. Is that correct?
Yeah, very close to it. In 1963, of course, Peace Corps was started. My wife, Diane, and I at that time went in Peace Corps in 1963 to Indonesia to work with sports and teaching English as a second language and teaching science. And we were always working with teachers in order that it would have a multiplier effect.
Well, how did you end up on Tonga?
We were in Indonesia, then briefly, or about 6 months, served in Thailand. Later on, had worked with Peace Corps Washington and went out to the Kingdom of Tonga in the South Pacific as an associate director of Peace Corps. And I was there 2.5 years in the Kingdom of Tonga, and then later on 2.5 years in the Philippines.
As I recall from your stories, you were there during Tongolese independence.
Yes.
And you got to meet the host of dignitaries. You want to talk about some of that?
It was a wonderful time to be there. Tonga was becoming an independent nation. It had been a British protectorate up until that time. The Queen of England then came to Tonga for the ceremonies of turning of over Tonga for its independence. The Tongans put on a feast that was unbelievable. I think they killed every pig on the island of Tonga Tapu. That's what you do for a big celebration and feast. And we were invited then to attend this. We were very close with the Queen. We got to sit within probably 35 or 40 feet. Well, some of the stories from Tonga and Indonesia and Micronesia and the Philippines and Thailand, I'm written a book and it should be published this July. The title of it is going to be Son of a Coal Miner's Daughter. In that book will be all about my growing up in Brown County and then serving in Peace Corps and stories from each of the countries that I was fortunate to serve in. So it's a memoir and it should be out by July.
Bill, I'm so interested in your childhood memories. Were you actually born in Brown County?
No, but I try to pass myself off as true Brown Countyan. We moved to Brown County when I was 3 years old because I do remember moving to Brown County. I was so happy because I could run and play and do all kinds of things outside. And it just seemed to be so open and free. And we moved onto this big old farm up above Bean Blossom. We had no electricity, no running water, no bathroom inside. But, you know, what's a little kid know and what's a little kid care about those things? For me, I thought it was the best thing that could be, and I still do. I just loved Brown County, and of course, went to school at Bean Blossom in a one-room school, and loved that, and thought that was a great thing. And then we moved briefly to Indianapolis during the Second World War, lived in Indianapolis about a year and a half, then came back to Brown County, finished grade school at Bean Blossom, and then went to Helmsburg. Right. But back at that time, one of the things I remember most was nobody's house had paint because nobody had any money to paint their houses. About every third or fourth house, as you traveled around the area, was empty because people didn't have enough money to pay for their taxes. So they would lose their property. And so there'd be a vacated farm here, and then there'd be some people living here, and then there'd be a vacated farm there, sparsely populated at that time. Mm-hmm. When a car went by your house, you knew exactly who it was because there were so few cars and so few people. Probably only about 4,000 to 5,000 people in Brown County in 1940 to 45. And the effects of the Great Depression on Brown County were very, very obvious because people had no money. People pitched together to do things, and Brown County, because of the lack of electricity, didn't have many of the things that some counties to the north had. A lot of the things that you kind of see in stories, that was the way Brown County was at that time. All of my memories about Brown County were good. Looking back, wonderful memories of growing up in Brown County.
What do you remember about the forests?
At that time, Brown County was extremely dry. Every fall, there would be lots of forest fires. Brown County and the people in Brown County, with the county agent, Farm Service Agency, were trying to help reestablish the forest. So it was a time when people were planting lots of trees. But each fall, there would be lots of forest fires. When the forest fires would start, they would bring a flatbed truck to your grade school, load all the kids on the back of the flatbed truck, give them a rake, haul us over to where the fire was, and we would rake a fire line. Now, can you imagine today how many lawsuits that would engender? But that was what you did. Everybody pitched in when there was a fire. That meant first graders up to, you know, sixth or seventh graders. This is what we do, and this is what's needed. You go do it. But the county had a big emphasis on reestablishing forest at that time because there had been such bad timbering in the previous years. They were reestablishing and planting locust trees and pine trees, anything to hold the soil in place.
Why do you say it was so dry? What?
Because the part of the problem with the Great Depression was that there had been a great drought that extended from out in Oklahoma area all the way across the Midwest. And Brown County was part of that. And it was extremely dry in from July on each year. And it wasn't till the late 50s that the drought began to end in Brown County and we began to get regular rains again.
This is Dave Seastrom with the Brown County Hour, and it's my pleasure this evening to be talking with Kara Barnhart. Kara, welcome to the studio. So glad to meet you.
Thank you very much, David. It's nice to be here.
Well, goodness, you know, you're all over the place. How about giving us a little bio to get started?
A little bio?
Well, I don't know if as much as you feel comfortable with.
I like to consider myself sort of retired at this point in my life. Teaching is my passion, and I run probably 50 to 60 students, no exaggeration, in and out of my cabin every week.
Wow.
Teaching all the instruments I play. I still can be talked into doing a little bit of touring and some studio work outside of the state, but you've really got to talk to me and butter me up to get me to leave the state these days.
Well, I mean, didn't you begin performing as a little child?
My mother had a singing group when I was just a baby, and they would use me as a prop. You know, I write about that in on my website, but they really did. They would dress me up and set me on the stage, and some of my earliest memories are of seeing audiences and glowing faces, just, you know, infinite amounts of heads out in an audience. Wow. Staring at me.
Back in the bio, just I ran into this quote that I love so much: descended from a host of bizarre vaudevillian performers. I mean,
right.
Would you elaborate on that?
My dad's dad, my grandfather, came up from Kentucky, and he was in vaudeville for quite a while. Quite a character. Played an old Gibson guitar. To this day, no one in my family claims responsibility for losing that Gibson guitar. But if I could ever get my hands on that, that would be tremendous. But he played and sang and swore that he wrote a lot of songs that we're not really sure he really wrote. Mm-hmm. But he played with a lot of people.
What style of music?
A lot of folky, Arkansas traveler almost funny tunes that he would take and put his own spin on. Some of them weren't, you wouldn't have wanted me to do any of them on the radio because they were, you know, it was quite risque.
Well, this is a family show.
I learned a lot of great words when I was a little kid.
Well, it's a good time to learn them, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Just get that out of the way.
Right up front.
You and your sister, obviously Pam has been a big part of your life, your whole life, but I love the dynamic of watching you guys perform. Unfortunately, I've never seen it live, but
right?
Yeah, the YouTubes are fantastic. I mean, the banter between the two and those harmonies.
There's nothing like sibling harmony. I mean, you can't beat sibling harmony, for one thing. But I think that my sister is the funniest human being on the planet, and she thinks the same of me. And so we can just look at each other, and it's hard to maintain.
Well, that really works.
Yeah. We have a great time.
So you were involved for years with the Weed Patch Music Company, and you've sold out to your partner now.
I did. I wanted to start the music store because we had to have a music store in this town. I mean, for years and years, Mountain Made Music was sort of the hub for all the musicians here, and people would come to town and they would need a musician for a wedding, and the first place they would call would be Mountain Made Music. It was sort of like our little agency down there. Without it, I just didn't feel like the musicians could really maintain any organization whatsoever. I'm not so sure that we accomplished that with Weed Patch, because we've got some incredible venues now in town, too, that are sort of serving that purpose. Bottom line was that musicians needed a place to pick up strings and picks and jam. And one of the biggest reasons really was for the local builders, too. And we've got a lot of instrument builders in Brown County that people don't know anything about.
That's
true. It's a venue for them.
Well, you're clearly an accomplished musician, and you're all over the place. We've got 7 CDs out there. How many instruments do you play?
I would have to count. I think Pam thinks I play 7, I think. But so let's see if it's true. It's a guitar, banjo, and mandolin are my 3 instruments. The mountain dulcimer, I will fake. You know, if the band is big enough, I'll play the fiddle, but the band's got to be really big for me to play the fiddle. Bass. A little bit of woodwind, musical saw, auto harp. I'll blow a harmonica if one's in front of me, but it's not.
I've just run out of digits.
Yeah, right. I'll play just about anything with strings. How about that?
You've been in Brown County how long?
Oh, that's the other question, right.
I've lived in Brown County, I believe I moved here when I was 28 or 29, and I'm 52 years old now, so I've been here for a while. I started out on Owl Creek Road, and then I migrated over to Coffee Hill, and now I'm up on Town Hill.
Why Brown County? You could live anywhere you want.
Yes. When I was small, my parents really got into painting for a while, and we were in Greene County. I grew up in Greene County, and so we were here every weekend, and they were out painting, and that went on for a while. But I've just always associated, when I was a little kid, Brown County was when I was with my parents when they were at their most relaxed.
There you go.
There was absolutely no stress. Everybody was relaxed. Everybody was breathing deeply and easily. I always associated Brown County with that. Then in my late teens, early 20s, I used to come here and sit out on the street and do caricatures. So I've been coming here for a long time, and I knew, I think when I was a little kid, that I wanted to settle in Brown County.
Well, caricatures is another form of performance.
It is. You bet.
Very much street
performance. It totally is. You've got to do things to get certain expressions on their faces, and you've got to keep those expressions, and you've got to keep them entertained, and yeah, absolutely.
So now you give what you know to students.
I give what I know to students. Yeah, and I play for benefits and things like that. You know, I'm always out and ready to have a good time. I play music because I want to play music, and I play music with who I want to play music with.
Do you want to talk about your experience in New York?
We can.
All right, and I'm going to try to say his name. Thich Nhat Hanh. Is that correct?
That is correct. Thich Nhat Hanh. Mm-hmm.
Thich Nhat Hanh. Mm-hmm. Blue Cliff Monastery, a 5-day retreat. 1,000 people in silence for 5 days. We were talking about this before the interview. You want to talk about that?
Sure. It was a life-changing experience. I think that I had gotten to a point in my life where it was time to start really looking at my spirituality and how that fed my music and my artwork. I had just watched a documentary. I don't even remember what documentary it was, but at the very end of the documentary, they were interviewing a few people, and this guy comes on, and it was Thich Nhat Hanh. And I don't know that I've ever smiled so much in my entire life. It's like my whole body lit up. And Thich Nhat Hanh is from, he's technically Vietnamese. But he lives in France, and I'm not much of a world traveler, but I knew at that moment that I would have to do whatever I had to do to find this man and spend some time with him. So fortunately, he was going to be in New York at his monastery, so I went out there for the retreat. It was wonderful.
I love the one part of the story where you were going to take his photograph, and he comes around, and when you actually saw him, you just couldn't take that picture.
No, I absolutely couldn't. I was hiding, actually, up on a balcony, and he would take us all out for a mindful meditative walk every day. And so I thought, well, I'm gonna skip the walk, and I'm gonna get a really good photograph of him as he walks past the garden that I'd been working in all week. And so I was hidden. You know, I thought I was hidden. I don't think you can really hide from Thich Nhat Hanh. And they walked, and he got right below the balcony. And he was right below me, and I've got my camera. And he bends down and picks up this little teeny tiny bright red leaf. And he holds it in his hand, and he just stares at it. And then in just one fell swoop, he turned right up at me and held the leaf up in the air and just looked at me like, you know, this is what it's really about, kid. And it's almost like you're electrocuted. You know, the energy that you feel running through you when you have a moment like that is indescribable. I mean, it was a turning point in my life. And all I could do was just smile. I couldn't take a picture.
Kara, tell us about this first tune, Runaway Train.
Runaway Train was recorded back when I was endorsed by Ovation Guitars. And I had set my Ovation guitar up with detuners, like you put on a banjo, so that I could rip through and change the tuning as I was playing. And also you would hear the note, you know, bow, like that. You hear some really strange notes happening, bending. And it's not a bend, though. It's actually me changing the tuner as I play. And it's just a lightning-fast fingerstyle piece. It's one track, one guitar, and it's the kind of stuff I used to compete with.
Now we pause for station identification.
The Brown County Hour is sponsored by Jerseyana Gallery in Nashville, where it's always a state of art. We showcase Indiana artisans of all ages. Stop by each month to check out featured local artists, poets, authors, and musicians in Nashville's only art salon. For more information, call 812-200-3133 or check out their webpage at allthews.jerseyana.org.
You are listening to the Brown County Hour on volunteer-powered community radio WFHB at 100.7 in Brown County, 91.3 and 98.1 in Bloomington, 106.3 in Ellettsville, and online at WFHB.org. Welcome back to episode 27 of the Brown County Hour. Bill Miller begins the next segment with his recollections on trying to save Elkinsville. We have another tune from Kara Barnard, and Jim Schultz will talk about the Salt Creek Restoration Project. Last but not least, we have our own Rick Fettig with another Brown County News update.
Bill, let's talk a little bit about Elkinsville. You're like the mayor, the sole occupant, the keeper of the flame. I know that are they still having their reunions every year?
Yeah, but this past year was the 25th reunion that held at my place. That was a stroke of luck that I found the property, including Browning Mountain, in 1967, purchased it in 1967, met somebody that wanted to have a reunion. So the people started coming back in 1987 to Elkinsville for the Elkinsville reunion, bringing their memories, and they wrote a couple of books. One's called Elkinsville, The Town That Was, and the second one is called The Dusty Road Leads to Elkinsville, and it is a dusty road, and it's still dusty. I got then to know so many of the people that had lived at Elkinsville, and what a treat, because these people really lived in an isolated part of the county, but were able to scratch out a living and have a community and have a good spirit of community with very little. And most of their memories, Brown County, theirs also were very good. The lack of money didn't seem to keep them from enjoying themselves and enjoying each other. I've tried to save some of the buildings at Elkinsville as best I can, the post office and what used to be the blacksmith shop at my house and in the house I live in, which was built in 1892. So it's been a kind of a lifelong endeavor and something that I've really enjoyed.
Well, I know that Elkinsville was a casualty of Lake Monroe, that it was declared a floodplain and condemned, and everybody was forced out. But I remember you talking about your personal attempts to help Elkinsville by meeting with then Indiana Senator Vance Hartke. You want to share that story?
Yeah, well, a few years later, after I had purchased the property, they were going to take all of the land in that end of the county to complete a wilderness, and it was going to be 32,000 acres, but it contained 5,000 acres of private property. I got involved in organizing all of the people in Brown County, Jackson County, Bartholomew County and Monroe County and Johnson County and Morgan County to make a political statement to these politicians that we didn't want any more of our land taken for the public endeavor. I happened to go to Washington and talk with different people, including Senator Vance Hartke. We were in his office, and he was somebody that liked Brown County and came to Brown County and liked the artist. So as we were talking to him, he said, well, there's an awfully good-looking painting of Dale Braziers in The Seasons. At that time, it was called The Ramada. I sure like that painting. And then we'd talk a little bit more about him helping us. And then he'd come back and he'd say, boy, I can see that painting on the wall, The Ramada. It sure is nice. Is Dale Braziers' painting still there? I really like that. About three or four times before we left his office, he was giving us a strong hint that really he could help us a lot more if he just had that painting that was on the wall of Dale Bazier's.
Well, he did kind of have that reputation.
Did he, in fact, help you?
He didn't hurt us. Sometimes you, in politics, you know, that's help. Lee Hamilton told me that, and we worked with Lee Hamilton and Senator Lugar, Andy Jacobs, and a lot of really great politicians. And one of the things I learned is if a politician doesn't hurt you, sometimes that's help. One of the bigger fights that I got into was with Birch Bayh, who was United States Senator at that time, and he was an advocate of taking our property. Ended up that he didn't like it because I had written some negative things about him, and he told the local Democrat county chairman that he wanted to make sure that I didn't have an opportunity to do anything in politics. So you can find out real quick when you get in these fights with politicians that it can get to be pretty rough and pretty dirty.
So did you have an ambition to be in politics?
You know, I sort of did at one time, and the more that I worked with politicians and with Washington, the more I decided that that really wasn't the road I wanted to go down, where all you really were spending your time doing was running around begging for money from big corporations. I thought that wasn't what my idea of what representing people amounted to, and so I chose not to go down that path.
And now back to Kara Barnard. Kara, this next piece, Salt Creek, what's its story?
Salt Creek is a well-known bluegrass instrumental piece. And honestly, I recorded Salt Creek just so I could sort of showcase all the instruments that I play being played as fast as I possibly can. As my father used to refer to it, as stupid fast. It is a stupid fast song, and I'm playing my instruments stupidly fast. A lot of instruments, a lot of notes.
Hi, this is Dave Seastrom with the Brown County Hour, and we have Jim Schultz with us talking about the Salt Creek Preservation Project that he and a group of folks are working on. Hi, Jim. You want to tell us a little bit about this project?
This project has actually been around for many years, maybe 5-6 years, various iterations, and it's come down in the last 2 years to closely working together group committed to achieving the original goals, which was to open Salt Creek up as a stream trail for canoes and kayaks.
Well, I know there's been terrible log jams, and that's one of the things you've been doing.
Indeed. Last summer, we removed a log jam from the what they call the Howard Farm. It was a very large log jam. Anybody that's driven out Green Valley Road towards Yellowwood has seen this log jam piled in the field. The next log jam, which we're getting started on, is a little bit farther to the west, and it's the second major log jam, which will be removed this summer. Then we'll be on to the next one. It's a seasonal thing.
Well, how many more until the creek is completely open?
There's probably one or two more major ones to the county line. And for right now, that's all the farther we can really go. We are starting to move forward with some sort of relationship with Monroe County to get them on board to take it from the Monroe County line. Speaking of the North Fork of Salt Creek, that empties into the Pine Grove area of Monroe Reservoir. The ultimate goal is to make it navigable all the way to Pine Grove.
Oh, that would be excellent. Well, this is going to be exclusively non-motorized paddling traffic.
That's correct.
Well, as someone that loves to kayak, I'm really looking forward to the day when I can paddle that.
And it'll probably mostly be a medium to high water event, because there's going to be certain times of the year, late summer, early fall, then unless we have a rain, it would still be fun, but you're going to have to get out and drag or portage from, you know, here, there, and yonder. So, but at medium to high water, I mean, we're talking a lot of fun.
You want to talk about the group a little bit and who the people are?
Again, this is just Brown County citizens that kind of come together because they care. I think we all have somewhat of a similar interest. I came to this because, as a youth, being around streams, creeks, very much a warm fuzzy, total warm fuzzy.
Yeah.
And so some of the other people are Eric Beers, Keith Baker, then Laura Young, Greg Wright, Rick Kelly, Mark Shields.
And Jim Schultz.
Well, yeah, and me. Together we make almost all of the meetings. I mean, we kind of break up and somebody's on vacation or whatever. And we all have our little specialities, too. I mean, some people are better at the grant writing, and some people are better at various aspects of all the things that have to be done, and we're all volunteers.
Jim, it's my understanding that there's going to be a canoe and kayak rental situation that will eventually be part of this program.
That's true. That has not necessarily been totally formatted yet. This all started with Brown County Parks and Rec and Mark Shields and Yolanda Tushlog. Hope I pronounced her last name correctly. They were the two champions that kind of brought it out of the ground. The starting point from our mission statement is Deer Run. The DNR is on board with a small craft launch ramp being put in at Deer Run. That would be in the 2015 year, which will give us an access point. There's been several discussed additional access points south. The first one in Brown County would be almost to the western edge of Salt Creek in Brown County, somewhere around Bean Blossom, potentially on the core ground just west of the TC Steel Road. And then the next one would be at Pine Grove itself. We do have our first play in the creek day, we'll call it. I don't think it has a name yet, but there's an event in Nashville that we are piggybacking on, and it is the first day of the summer, June 21st. We are going to have a canoe race, we're going to call it. This is depending upon how high the water is, and this kind of changed our mission a bit. It's going to start at the state park.
Nice.
Up until this point, the state park has not really been involved, but this particular race will be from the state park to Deer Run. We've got the local Troop 190 Boy Scouts on board doing part of the work as far as spotters and whatnot. I think it's going to be a really good kickoff event.
Well, do you guys have a website or a Facebook page?
We do. We have, I know we have a Facebook page, and the website is still cooking. It's not quite ready yet.
How do we get to your Facebook page?
It's Salt Creek Preservation Group. Just that.
All right.
And
I'll be liking you tomorrow.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, and I've got some great pictures I took of Salt Creek today, but fortunately this is radio and I can't show them to you.
Well, that is one of our limitations, but you know everyone's good looking on the radio, Jim.
I know.
Yeah.
I understand. Even Garrison.
Yeah, we'll probably leave that part out.
Not likely.
Well, the thing, you know, this really is a wonderful project.
Yeah. I mean, I love it.
I think, yeah. You know, I've been reading about it for years now, mm-hmm. and it's just great that this has finally happened. Is there a projected time when all the log jams will be cleared and the waterway in Brown County itself will be clear?
After we get this log jam out that we're working on next, and that's at the Bond Cemetery Road. anybody that wants to go out to the creek, the Bond Cemetery has a bridge over it, and it's an old iron bridge. It's a really cool bridge.
Yeah.
And this particular logjam was immediately west or south of this bridge, but just that area right there is just pristinely beautiful. Standing there, you can't tell what decade you're in. Once we get this logjam out there, I think there's only one more big one till Belmont.
Okay.
And so that's going to make probably, I don't know, 12, 13, 14 miles of the creek navigable.
Wow. There's a wrinkle with the process. You can't put any heavy equipment in the water. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And so how is this done then?
It's a combination of cabling, using track machines, pulling
heavy
it out.
Winches. And
Yep. And in the last logjam last year, there was a lot of broken cables. And then the other thing is track hose, excavators with thumbs.
Right.
And but the combination of those two pieces of equipment, those are the primary pieces used for the logjam removal.
Sounds like quite a project.
It's very interesting to watch. And
well, yeah, we all grew up with Tonka toys. There you go.
We did.
And the big boys, they're even better.
Yep.
So if a person today wanted to go kayaking,
there's places at Deer Run where you can actually get down to the creek. It's a little steep. It's a little tricky. It's not for the faint of heart. There are numerous places as you're going down the creek where people who farm there have fords, and those areas are real easy to get in and get out of. And if anybody knows anybody who lives along Salt Creek that has one of these particular areas, they could ask them for permission to put in there. But for right now, you could launch at the state park too. Again, you have the same tricky kind of steep bank situation. And I understand that for this June 21st event, that they're going to make some sort of a temporary ramp to the point where we can launch there.
Is this event free and open to the public? Or?
It's open to the public. I think that there may be a admission charge if you want to compete in the race.
Oh, to help raise funds.
To help raise funds. It will be very nominal fee. And we're hoping that it is the first of many of these events, maybe some earlier in the year when we typically would have more high water. There was an incident when I was growing up that was kind of a fluke. And then it turned out to be this event. I went to high school in Indianapolis and lived in the Broad Ripple area.
Are we talking about the raft race?
The raft race, yes. And so there was actual discussions as to whether or not we should have some sort of raft race.
It was such a fun event until they regulated it to the point where it wasn't fun anymore.
Correct, yeah.
And then people stopped going and then the event went away.
Right.
Gee,
right.
Funny how that happens.
Yeah. But, you know, it wasn't really going to be in the same vein as that, but we were talking about people making boats and see how far they could get down the creek in them.
So long as they pulled them back out when they're done.
Oh, yes, absolutely. That would be a requirement. Yeah.
Yeah. This is Dave Seastrom with the Brown County Hour. Thank you very much, Jim.
Thank you.
And now, with another Brown County update, it's Rick Fettig.
Well, we've had a big month in Brown County. Locally, the kitchen table has become quite popular again. There were two home births, and all the family and friends were around in the living room cheering on. And we had one break-in, and there was a burglar who got his buttocks filled with buckshot. And we have our own Bridget Gates. Bridget Gates announces her upcoming wedding to Chris Thirsty. And there was a buffalo scene on the west side of Brown County. And unlike the big oil people and big oil companies who refuse to invest in renewable energies because they have no vision and are afraid they won't continue to make their bazillions of dollars off the dead dinosaurs, our local moonshiners have figured out how to advance their endeavors. The nasal inhalers that people use when they're on oxygen, well, the moonshiners have developed a way to connect that to their ball jar lids. And the moonshiners are now recycling those mason jars and filling them with Brown County air and marketing them across America. Now people in New York, Miami, LA can now breathe Brown County air. The moonshiners don't even have to make anything. For instance, the moonshine. It's a windfall, if you will, and it's bringing in buku bucks into the community. And we'd have more of the sheriff's log, but it's involved in a jam on Salt Creek. This is Rick Fettig with the latest news from Brown County.
Now we pause for station identification.
Brown County Hour is underwritten by Riverlight Yoga, where you will find expert instruction in a completely equipped, newly enlarged studio. We offer a variety of classes with individual instruction as specialty. Gift certificates in any denomination are available. See riverlightyoga.com for full information.
You are listening to the Brown County Hour on volunteer-powered community radio WFHB at 100.7 in Brown County, 91.3 and 98.1 in Bloomington, 106.3 in Ellettsville, and online at wfhb.org.
Welcome back to the final segment of episode 27 of the Brown County Hour. We begin with an essay from Dave Seastrom, followed by some more music from Kara Barnard. And we close the show with Mike Hayter and the Ukulele World Congress.
This is Dave Seastrom with the Brown County Hour. It's been a lovely spring so far here in Brown County. All of our early flowers are behind us, and the serious work of gardening has begun in earnest. Personally, I love to garden. There's a magic to watching seeds become produce or flowers. In Brown County, we don't have much in the way of good soil. When the forest was clear-cut 100 years ago, it caused a huge amount of erosion, and most of our deep forest loam ended up somewhere in the Gulf of Mexico. There are pockets of good soil here and there, but mostly it's to be found in the valleys. My wife and I live on a ridgetop, and our soil is the typically thin, mostly clay soil so common here. As the old-timers would say, it's good for growing rocks and weeds, but not much else. But if you have an itch to garden, poor soil is where the adventure begins. Building good soil from scratch is the first step towards homegrown tomatoes, and there's a couple of ways to do this. Manure is a logical means to amend the soil, and there's lots of places you can go to find this aromatic elixir. There's lots of horses and cows here, and a little networking you can yield bountiful source free for the taking. Many a spring morning has found me with a manure fork in my hands, filling the pickup to the brim and hauling it home to spread it over the garden. I developed a preference for horse poop. In smell and texture, it's a lot friendlier than the bovine version. If you clean out a stall, the desired product is often tangled with hay, which makes the work a lot harder. Pasture droppings are usually not tangled in hay and tend to be dry and accommodating. Unfortunately, in my experience, even if you compost the manure, it's full of weed seeds. This combination is ideal for the weeds, but not so much for the gardener. As a consequence, I've developed another plan. I compost leaves. When you live in a hardwood forest, you always have plenty of leaves. In fact, they make their way to the ground every fall in huge abundance, and all you have to do is gather them up and let them rot. I've found if you run over them with a mower, they compost a lot quicker. Leaves will rot slower than manure, and my piles take about 18 months to mature. Every fall, I mow the leaves and gather them into one big pile. The next fall, I run the tiller over the partially composted leaves and turn the pile, making room for the next crop. Come the following spring, the material is ready to use. Once you start this process, you have a fresh batch every year. I like the compost leaves make. It doesn't stink, it's good for the soil, and best of all, it has no weed seeds. Now you might think amending our poor soil is the biggest garden challenge we face, and nothing could be further from the truth. No, our biggest challenge comes in the form of predatory herbivores, better known as Bambi. These wily fur bearers exist in great numbers, can jump tall fences in a single bound, and devour your garden in the blink of an eye. Unless you're a commercial grower or have a deprivation permit, it's illegal to shoot them, so you must find a passive means of dealing with them. There are many folk remedies people swear by. Bars of stinky soap hung in the garden, or nylon socks filled with human hair. Exotic feline urine or the human kind applied liberally around the perimeter of the garden. All have their followers. None of these things work for me. The first couple of seasons in our new garden spot, the deer didn't seem to notice, and we produced decent gardens without much fuss. But over time, the deer discovered our laboriously produced snack bar and wiped us out. The first defense I came up with was to wire a switch leg from a motion detector to a small electric motor with a short piece of chain attached to it suspended in a metal bucket. The deer would come into the garden, set off the motion detector. The lights would come on, and the bucket and chain would produce enough racket the deer would fertilize the garden on their way out. This worked pretty good, unless they had already tasted the sugar snaps, and then nothing would stop them. I was never bothered by the noise. The device would go off in the middle of the night, and I would smile, roll over, and fall back asleep, content that my garden was being protected. But being the considerate fellow that I am, when our new neighbors moved in, I decided to make a change and go with electric fence. Electric fence doesn't cost much, and it works pretty good most years. The hitch is, the soil must be moist to complete the circuit. The way this works, the deer standing on the ground put their nose in the wire, complete the circuit, and get the shock of their life. When the soil is excessively dry, this can't take place, and the drought we had a couple of summers ago left us completely defenseless. Well, we were left with a couple of options: quit gardening or build a fence. For years now, we've been reluctant to do this. After all, no one wants to gulag their view. I did some research and decided to go with 6-foot-tall black plastic fence community gardens use. It took about 25 years of evolution to come to this, but we're very pleased with the outcome. The fence absolutely keeps deer out, and it's unobtrusive. This is what gardening is all about, adaptation. It's a never-ending process, and there's joy in this. There's always something new on your way to a fresh Brandywine, but oh, the pleasure when you finally arrive. This is Dave Seastrom with the Brown County Hour. See you next time. And now back with Kara Barnard. So, appropriately, for our final tune, Final Trail. What's the story behind that?
Final Trail is a song that I wrote when I was down in Tennessee, and I had day hiked a section of the Appalachian Trail. And I think that one of the reasons that I thought you might want to feature it is just because we're not really talking about my lyrics much today, but it's a fine example of the lyrics that I write. I always like to think that because I'm an artist and I make a living making art and music, that the two of them are really hand in hand. They're woven at all times. So when I'm writing songs, I'm thinking visually, and when I'm creating things visually, I'm hearing music. So Final Trail has got, it's a very visual song, and it's a very spiritual song. And it speaks a lot about how I feel about Brown County as well.
Run down the dirt path and ring the church bell 6 times for a woman who lived her life well. The clangor repeating the dull cry of bronze against the blue mountains I've lived my life on. Plow the field under and put up the hay. Open the barn, let the calico stray. Take my hens to the market in town. Till over my garden and let loose the hounds. When you hear my death rattle, don't weep anymore. It's only an angel shaking my door, shaking my door, and calling to me with pink lady slippers and butterfly weed, yellow fringed orchids and red columbine. Trace every footstep I take as I climb this new trail before me. Is showered in light as I walk to the crest of my mountain tonight. Lay me down in my cabin to sleep. Fit me for hiking with boots on my feet. A Fair Isle sweater and breeches to fill. Pockets with stories I wrote on this trail. A picture of you lay over my heart. Face face down on my bosom, never to part. Place neath my fingers an astral bouquet, and I'll greet you with flowers in heaven someday. When you hear my death rattle, don't weep anymore. It's only an angel shaking my door, and calling to me with pink lady slippers and butterfly weed, yellow fringed orchids and red columbine. Trace every footstep I take as I climb. This new trail before me is showered in light as I walk to the crest of my mountain tonight. Throw 6 feet of clay o'er this body of mine in a six-sided casket of poplar and pine. High on my mountain, painted with snow, where the trees lean crooked from the hard winds ablow. Remember me to the ones who are young, that follow our footprints and keep our ways strong. Tell them dying's a tariff we pay to the land. We're born from these mountains they bury us in. When you hear my death rattle, don't weep anymore. It's only an angel shaking my door, and calling to me with pink lady slippers and butterfly weed, yellow fringed orchids and red columbine. Trace every footstep I take as I climb. This new trail before me is showered in light as I walk to the crest of my mountain tonight.
So, Kara, tell us about your websites.
KaraBarnard.com. It doesn't get any easier than that. You just have to know how to spell my name. It's Kara with a K. The other website that I'm hoping everyone will visit is IndianaStringFest.com, and that's the website for the fingerstyle competition.
Kara, thank you so much for coming in this evening. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you very much for having me. I love what you guys are doing here. It's wonderful.
We appreciate that. This is Dave Seastrom with the Brown County Hour. Hi, this is Dave Seastrom with the Brown County Hour, and we're interviewing Mike Hader. Mike is a well-known local person who's involved in ukuleles on all kinds of levels, including his store, Mainland Ukes. Why don't you talk about the festival that's coming up?
We've got the Ukulele World Congress coming up June 5th and 6th. This will be the sixth year, and it started kind of as a joke. Some guys I knew from YouTube and some of the ukulele forums online, we're all talking and watching each other's videos, and none of us had ever met. And so I said, hey, I got the great place. We should all get together. And so it just kind of is tongue-in-cheek, I called it the Ukulele World Congress. Expected maybe 30 people there the first year. Lo and behold, we had over 100 the first year, including people from overseas, Australia, France, and all over the States. And it has just grown every year since then.
How many people do you expect this year?
I would say at least 500-600.
Wow.
It always varies a little bit because of the weather.
Let's talk about the origin of the ukulele. It's not just Hawaiian, is it?
Really, it kind of came from Spain. There was a guy, his last name was Nunes, who immigrated to Hawaii to cut sugarcane. They came to Hawaii and they started making ukuleles, and they just caught on. He gave up on cutting sugarcane and just made ukulele.
Well, what I love is that ukulele now is played in all styles of music.
It is.
I've heard classic pieces. I've heard Beatles music. I've heard jazz. I mean, it seems that the reach is infinite.
That's really true. And, you know, people associate it with Hawaiian music or maybe, you know, the old 20s stuff. But like you said, there's people doing jazz and blues. And the one fun thing about our party out there is we have an open mic both nights, and everybody gets two songs. And it doesn't matter if you're a pro or a beginner, you get two songs. And so it's pretty fun. Every 10 minutes, there's something totally different. You know, you get somebody coming up there and doing some Tin Pan Alley songs, and then the next guy comes up is some young kid who's doing Lady Gaga, you know, and then after that, you got somebody doing a couple really nice Hawaiian numbers, and then, you know, somebody comes up after that and does some Ramones, you know. You can see how versatile the instrument is. But the one thing it's really in common with it is just such a fun instrument, and the people drawn to it are just a hoot. You know, with guitar players, you kind of get a big broad spectrum of society. You know, with a ukulele, you can't be pretentious. You can't try to be some big, cool rock star. You know, you're just true. It's just what it is. Sure, you can be a rock star, but you can't fake it with a ukulele. June 4th, we're having an event at Muddy Boots, kind of a warm-up for the World Congress. I think it starts about 6 o'clock. They had it last year, and it is a great time. Packed house. Come and see some ukulele players from all over the country and probably outside the country as well.
Well, Mike, it sounds like a wonderful time. Thank you so much for coming in. This is Dave Seastrom with the Brown County Hour.
My pleasure.
Thanks for tuning in to episode 27 of the Brown County Hour, recorded in our studio at the History Center here in downtown Nashville and broadcast from WFHB the first Sunday of every month at 9 a.m. and the following Wednesday at 6 p.m. You can stream this or any of our shows at our website, browncountyhour.com. And while you're there, take a look at our Woodwatch page devoted to informing the public about the situation our forest lands are experiencing. And be sure to like us on Facebook. This show was produced by Jeff Foster and Pam Rader and co-produced by Rick Fettig, Vera Grubbs, and Dave Seastrom. Executive producer for WFHB is Allison Bechtesh. Special thanks to our guest host, Cheeky Rose. And once again, it's my extreme privilege to thank Slats Klug for our theme music. Listening to the Brown County Hour.
Coming to you from deep in the woods of Brown County, Indiana.
Celebrating the arts, culture, and nature that make this such a unique community.
Visit us online at browncountyhour.com.
The Brown County Hour is a production of WFHB.
Volunteer-powered, listener-supported community radio for South Central Indiana.
Take me back to my home, Brown County. Oh.